A wizard looking for a woman? Well, that's something new, said Lark. I'd have thought this would be weevily by now, but it's perfectly good. I'll bake up a bannock or two, shall I? Where's the oil? I'll need to draw some from the crock in the cool room. Oh, Shandy, there you are. How are you? How's Clearbrook? How's everything been? Did you sell the ram lambs? They sat down, nine, to supper. In the soft yellow light of the evening in the stone-floored kitchen at the long farm table, Theroux began to lift her head a little and spoke a few times to the other children. But there was still a cowering in her, and as it grew darker outside, she sat so that her seeing eye could watch the window. Not until Lark and her children had gone home in the twilight, and Apple was singing Theroux to sleep, and she was washing up the dishes with Shandy, did Tenar ask about Ged. Somehow, she had not wanted to, while Lark and Apple were listening. There would have been too many explanations. She had forgotten to mention his being at Realbi at all, and she did not want to talk about Realbi any more. Her mind seemed to darken when she tried to think of it. Did a man come here last month from me to help out with the work? Oh, I clean forgot, cried Shandy. Hawk, you mean? Him with the scars on his face? Yes, Tenar said. Hawk. Oh, aye, well, he'll be away up on Hot Springs Mountain, above Lisu, up there with the sheep, with Sari's sheep, I believe. He come here and says how you sent him, and there wasn't a lick of work for him here, you know, with Clearbrook and me looking after the sheep. And I've been dairying and old Tiff and Sis helping me out when needed. And I racked my brains, but Clearbrook, he says, go ask Sari's man, Farmer Sari's overseer, up by Kahedanan. Do they need herders in the high pastures, he said. And that hawk went off and did that, and got took on, and was off next day. Go ask Sari's man, Clearbrook told him, and that's what he done, and got took right on. So, he'll be back down with the flocks come fall, no doubt. Up there on the long fells above Lisu in the high pastures. I think maybe it was goats they wanted him for. Nice spoken fella. Sheep or goats, I don't remember which. I hope it's all right with you that we didn't keep him on here, Goha. But it's the truth, there wasn't a lick of work for him, what with me and Clearbrook and old Tiff and Sis got the flax in. And he said he'd been a goat herd over there where he come from, way round the mountain, some place above Armouth, he said, though he said he'd never herded sheep. Maybe it'll be goats they got him with up there. Maybe, said Tenar. She was much relieved and much disappointed. She had wanted to know him safe and well, but she had wanted also to find him here. But it was enough, she told herself, simply to be home. And maybe better that he was not here, that none of all that was here, all the griefs and dreams and wizardries and terrors of Realbi left behind for good. She was here now, and this was home, these stone floors and walls, these small-paned windows, outside which the oaks stood dark in starlight, these quiet, orderly rooms. She lay awake a while that night. Her daughter slept in the next room, the children's room, with Theroux, and Tenar lay in her own bed, her husband's bed, alone. She slept. She woke, remembering no dream. After a few days at the farm, she scarcely gave a thought to the summer past on the Overfell. It was long ago and far away. Despite Shandy's insistence on there not being a lick of work to be done about the farm, she found plenty that needed doing. All that had been left undone over the summer, and all that had to be done in the season of harvest in the fields and dairy. She worked from daybreak till nightfall, and if by chance she had an hour to sit down, she spun or sewed for Theroux. The red dress was finished at last, and a pretty dress it was, with a white apron for fancy wear, and an orangey-brown one for every day. "Ah, then you look beautiful," said Tenar, in her seamstress's pride, when Theroux first tried it on. Theroux turned her face away. "You are beautiful," Tenar said in a different tone. "Listen to me, Theroux. Come here. You have scars, ugly scars, because an ugly, evil thing was done to you. People see the scars, but they see you, too. And you aren't the scars. You aren't ugly. You aren't evil. You are Theroux and beautiful. You are Theru, who can work and walk and run and dance beautifully in a red dress. The child listened, the soft, unhurt side of her face as expressionless as the rigid scar-mask side. She looked down at Tenar's hands and presently touched them with her small fingers. "It is a beautiful dress," she said in her faint, hoarse voice. When Tenar was alone, folding up the scraps of red material, tears came stinging into her eyes. She felt rebuked. She had done right to make the dress, and she had spoken the truth to the child. But it was not enough, the right and the truth. There was a gap, a void, a gulf, on beyond the right and the truth. Love, her love for Theru, and Theru's for her, made a bridge across that gap, a bridge of spiderweb, but love did not fill or close it. Nothing did that, and the child knew it better than she. The day of the equinox came, a bright sun of autumn burning through the mist. The first bronze was in the leaves of the oaks. As she scrubbed cream pans in the dairy with the window and door wide open to the sweet air, Tenar thought that her young king was being crowned this day in Havnar. The lords and ladies would walk in their clothes of blue and green and crimson, but he would wear white, she thought. He would climb up the steps to the Tower of the Sword, the steps she and Ged had climbed. The crown of Morred would be placed on his head. He would turn as the trumpets sounded and seat himself on the throne that had been empty so many years, and look at his kingdom with those dark eyes that knew what pain was, what fear was. Rule well, rule long, she thought. Poor boy. And she thought, it should have been Ged there putting the crown on his head. He should have gone. But Ged was herding the rich man's sheep, or maybe goats, up in the high pastures. It was a fair, dry, golden autumn, and they would not be bringing the flocks down till the snow fell up there on the heights. When she went into the village, Tenar made a point of going by Ivy's cottage at the end of Mill Lane. Getting to know Moss at Realby had made her wish to know Ivy better. If she could once get past the witch's suspicion and jealousy. She missed Moss, even though she had Lark here. She had learned from her and had come to love her, and Moss had given both her and Theru something they needed. She hoped to find a replacement of that here. But Ivy, though a great deal cleaner and more reliable than Moss, had no intention of giving up her dislike of Tenar. She treated her overtures of friendship with the contempt that, Tenar admitted, they perhaps deserved. "You go your way, I go mine," the witch told her in everything but words. And Tenar obeyed, though she continued to treat Ivy with marked respect when they met. She had, she thought, slighted her too often and too long, and owed her reparation. Evidently agreeing, the witch accepted her due with unbending ire. In mid-autumn, the sorcerer Beech came up the valley, called by a rich farmer to treat his gout. He stayed on a while in the Middle Valley villages, as he usually did, and passed one afternoon at Oak Farm, checking up on Theru and talking with Tenar. He wanted to know anything she would tell him of Ogeon's last days. He was a pupil of Ogeon's, and a devout admirer of the Mage of Gaunt. Tenar found it was not so hard to talk about Ogeon as about other people of Realby, and told him all she could. When she had done, he asked a little cautiously, "And the Archmage, did he come?" "Yes," Tenar said. Beech, a smooth-skinned, mild-looking man in his 40s, tended a little to fat, with dark half-circles under his eyes that belied the blandness of his face, glanced at her and asked nothing. "He came after Ogeon's death and left," she said. And presently, "He's not Archmage now. You knew that?" Beech nodded. "Is there any word of their choosing a new Archmage?" The sorcerer shook his head. "There was a ship in from the Enlades not long ago, but no word from her crew of anything but the coronation. They were full of that. And it sounds as if all auspices and events were fortunate. If the goodwill of mages is valuable, then this young king of ours is a rich man. And an active one, it seems. There's an order come overland from Gauntport just before I left Valmouth for the nobles and merchants and the mayor and his council to meet together and see to it that the bailiffs of the district be worthy and accountable men. For they're the king's officers now, and are to do his will and enact his law. Well, you can imagine how Lord Hino greeted that. Hino was a notable patron of pirates, who had long kept most of the bailiffs and sea sheriffs of South Gaunt in his pocket. But there were men willing to face up to Hino, with the king standing behind them. They dismissed the old lot then and there, and named 15 new bailiffs, decent men, paid out of the mayor's funds. Hino stormed off swearing destruction. It's a new day. Not all at once, of course, but it's coming. I wish Master Ogeon had lived to see it. He did, Tenar said. As he was dying, he smiled and he said, "All changed." Beach took this in his sober way, nodding slowly. "All changed," he repeated. After a while, he said, "The little one's doing very well." "Well enough. Sometimes I think not well enough." "Mistress Goha," said the sorcerer, "if I or any sorcerer or witch, or I dare say wizard, had kept her, and used all the power of healing of the art magic for her all these months since she was injured, she wouldn't be better off. Maybe not as well as she is. You have done all that can be done, mistress. You have done a wonder." She was touched by his earnest praise, and yet it made her sad, and she told him why. "It isn't enough," she said. "I can't heal her. She's... what is she to do? What will become of her?" She ran off the thread she had been spinning onto the spindle shank and said, "I am afraid." "For her," Beach said, half querying. "Afraid because her fear draws to it, to her, the cause of her fear. Afraid because..." But she could not find the words for it. "If she lives in fear, she will do harm," she said at last. "I'm afraid of that." The sorcerer pondered. "I've thought," he said at last, in his diffident way, "that maybe if she has the gift, as I think she does, she might be trained a bit in the art. And, as a witch, her appearance wouldn't be so much against her, possibly." He cleared his throat. "There are witches who do very creditable work," he said. Tenar ran a little of the thread she had spun between her fingers, testing it for evenness and strength. "Ogeon told me to teach her. Teach her all," he said. "And then, not roke." I don't know what he meant. Beach had no difficulty with it. "He meant that the learning of roke, the high arts, wouldn't be suitable for a girl," he explained, "let alone one so handicapped. But if he said to teach her all but that lore, it would seem that he too saw her way might well be the witch's way." He pondered again more cheerfully, having got the weight of Ogeon's opinion on his side. "In a year or two, when she's quite strong and grown a bit more, you might think of asking Ivy to begin teaching her a bit. Not too much, of course, even of that kind of thing, till she has her true name." Tenar felt a strong, immediate resistance to the suggestion. She said nothing, but Beach was a sensitive man. "Ivy's dour," he said, "but what she knows she does honestly, which can't be said of all witches. Weak as women's magic, you know, and wicked as women's magic. But I've known witches with real healing power. Healing befits a woman. It comes natural to her. And the child might be drawn to that, having been so hurt herself." His kindness was, Tenar thought, innocent. She thanked him, saying that she would think carefully about what he had said. And indeed she did so. Before the month was out, the villages of Middle Valley had met at the round barn of Sodiva to appoint their own bailiffs and officers of the peace and to levy a tax upon themselves to pay the bailiffs' wages with. Such were the king's orders, brought to the mayors and elders of the villages, and readily obeyed, for there were as many sturdy beggars and thieves on the road as ever, and the villagers and farmers were eager to have order and safety. Some ugly rumors went about, such as that Lord Hino had formed a council of scoundrels, and was enlisting all the blackguards in the countryside to go about in gangs, breaking the heads of the king's baileys. But most people said, "Just let 'em try," and went home telling each other that now an honest man could sleep safe abed at night, and what went wrong the king was setting right, though the taxes were beyond all reason, and they'd all be poor men forever trying to pay them. Tenor was glad to hear of all this from Lark, but did not pay it much heed. She was working very hard. And since she had got home, she had, almost without being aware of it, resolved not to let the thought of Handy or any such ruffian rule her life or Theroux's. She could not keep the child with her every moment, renewing her terrors, forever reminding her of what she could not remember and live. The child must be free and know herself to be free to grow in grace. She had gradually lost the shrinking, fearful manner, and by now went all about the farm and the byways, and even into the village by herself. Tenar said no word of caution to her, even when she had to prevent herself from doing so. Theroux was safe on the farm, safe in the village. No one was going to hurt her. That must be taken as unquestionable. And indeed, Tenar did not often question it. With herself and Shandy and Clearbrook around the place, and Sis and Tiff down in the lower house, and Lark's family all over the village, in the sweet autumn of the Middle Valley, what harm was going to come to the child? She'd get a dog, too, when she heard of one she wanted. One of the big, gray, gaunty sheep guards, with their wise, curly heads. Now and then, she thought, as she had at Rayalby, "I must be teaching the child. Ogeon said so." But somehow, nothing seemed to get taught to her but farm work and stories in the evening, as the nights drew in, and they began to sit by the kitchen fire after supper before they went to bed. Maybe Beach was right, and Theroux should be sent to a witch to learn what witches knew. It was better than apprenticing her to a weaver, as Tenar had thought of doing. But not all that much better. And she was still not very big, and was very ignorant for her age, for she had been taught nothing before she came to Oak Farm. She had been like a little animal, barely knowing human speech, and no human skills. She learned quickly, and was twice as obedient and diligent as Lark's unruly girls and laughing, lazy boys. She could clean and serve and spin, cook a little, sew a little, look after poultry, fetch the cows, and do excellent work in the dairy. A proper farm lassie, old Tiff called her, fawning a bit. Tenar had also seen him make the sign to avert evil surreptitiously when Theroux passed him. Like most people, Tiff believed that you are what happens to you. The rich and strong must have virtue. One to whom evil has been done must be bad, and may rightly be punished. In which case, it would not help much if Theroux became the properest farm lassie in Gaunt. Not even prosperity would diminish the visible brand of what had been done to her. So, Beach had thought of her being a witch, accepting, making use of the brand. Was that what Ogeon had meant when he said, "Not roke"? When he said, "They will fear her"? Was that all? One day, when a managed chance brought them together in the village street, Tenar said to Ivy, "There's a question I want to ask you, Mistress Ivy, a matter of your profession." The witch eyed her. She had a scathing eye. "My profession, is it?" Tenar nodded, steady. "Come on, then," Ivy said with a shrug, leading off down Mill Lane to her little house. It was not a den of infamy and chickens like Moss's house, but it was a witch house. The beams hung thick with dried and drying herbs, the fire banked under gray ash with one tiny coal winking like a red eye, a lithe, fat, black cat with one white mustache, sleeping up on a shelf, and everywhere a profusion of little boxes, pots, ewers, trays, and stoppered bottles, all aromatic, pungent, or sweet, or strange. "What can I do for you, Mistress Goha?" Ivy asked, very dry, when they were inside. "Tell me, if you will, If you think my ward, Daru, has any gift for your art, any power in her. She? Of course, said the witch. Tenar was a bit floored by the prompt and contemptuous answer. Well, she said. Beach seemed to think so. A blind bat in a cave could see it, said Ivy. Is that all? No, I want your advice. When I've asked my question, you can tell me the price of the answer. Fair? Fair. Should I apprentice Theru for a witch when she's a bit older?